there and you're going someplace else. It took a long time.
The tail gunner, alone at the far end of the fuselage, was responsible for guarding the most valuable side of the aircraft. Phil Azure remembered with vivid amazement the first time he saw an enemy jet knife through his formation, and with sadness on other occasions as he watched planes full of comrades disintegrate and fall to earth. Don Anderson faced the reality of his situation with a touch of gallows humor.
Yeah.
Well, the tail gunner position was one that the German fighters wanted to kill the tail gunner first if they possibly could. Because then it was easier to shoot down the plane if they could kill the tail gunner. But I never told my mother that. She never knew about that. So.
Well, I was just a high school kid, really, 19 years old, and just did what I was told. And I was sad that I didn't get to be a pilot like God had intended, but that's life. So got to be philosophical about the whole thing.
When not flying, members of the crew would blow off stress in the flak shack, a converted English manor house.
I was in the flak shack, which was an old English manor, a beautiful, beautiful place, and they gave us excellent service. What they did was the strain of combat flying was so great that we needed a break near the end of our tour, so they sent us off for a week, and when the war ended. We all went to town, and whoopee, you know, gee, the fires were going, and people were hugging, and everybody was happy, the war is over. And I walked around, I met this girl, and she was by herself, and I was by myself. And so I said, hi, my name is Don. And she said, hello, my name is Jane Eyre. And I had never heard of Charlotte Bronte or her book with the unhappy heroine. And I said, well, nice to meet you, Jane. I believed her. So for 71 years, I went around chuckling to myself over how sharp that girl was to give me a phony name so I wouldn't pester her anymore.
Almost all of the veterans we spoke with were still teenagers when they were pulled from home and school and sent overseas. And though the military entrusted them with its most sophisticated technology and thousands of pounds of munitions on vital and dangerous missions, the irony of their youth was apparent when they returned home.
And after the war was over, I came back. Decorations, combat veteran, wanted to get married. They said, no, you can't get married. You have to have your mother's permission because you're only 20 years old. Come on. But that's just one of the vagaries of the time.
After the war, Don and the other veterans present tried to maintain the friendships forged in war, but this wasn't always a simple task in the pre-information age.
We came back to the United States, and I was from the Northwest. One of them was from Los Angeles area. The others were from back east and Florida and all over. And I had a heck of a time getting in touch with them. I had the addresses for some of them. We exchanged Christmas cards, and I had to write to the VA, and I wrote to the hometown newspapers. Finally rounded up all of them, found them.
And now, each passing year thins their ranks. Most of the flyers describe themselves as the last of their crews. Don is a little luckier and is still in contact with one other airman from the Joker.
There's only one other guy left now. That's the Bombardier, and he lives in Massachusetts. Dory and I went to visit him a few years ago and talked to him and his wife, and it was great to see him. All the rest of them are gone.
Don Anderson, 91 years old and wearing the flight suit he was issued at age 19, was glad to be able to visit this impressive and near-legendary object from his youth and contemplated its present-day significance.
But it's great to see the plane, and it's nice that they're still flying, and it's nice that people show their appreciation so we can show our appreciation for the freedom that we all enjoy. That's what we're here for. And so in a world full of hate, it's nice to see that there's still love around.
At the age of 19, Jim Street found himself stationed in Italy, not only as a pilot, but also as the flight commander of a squadron of B-17s.
I was with the 483rd Bomb Group in the 15th Air Force in Italy, near Foggia. I had the rank of a captain. I was a flight commander. And so what I did, I led squadron flight, which is normally seven planes. And we were part of a group flight, which would be four squadrons, a total of 28 planes. I was actually a fighter pilot at heart. But for luck of the draw, I got the B-17. And I was very unhappy about that. However, when I was all over and done, I was very pleased with the B-17.
After leaving the military, Jim flew planes commercially for a while.
When I got back from the service, I went to Oregon State College University. Mm-hmm. That first summer, I got a job flying a salesman all around the United States during the summer months.
What kind of plane was that?
It was called a Funk, F-U-N-K.
I'm not familiar with that.
Well, most people aren't. But there happens to be one in the museum up at Hood River.
But of all the planes he flew, Jim claims the best was a B-17, for one important and poignant reason.
It's a great airplane. Wonderful plane to fly. It was my favorite because we got through the war and came home.
If this were television, this is where we would show you around the Madras Maiden, on the ground and in the air. But this being radio, we'll do our best to describe the experience for you. If you imagine for yourself what it might be like to be inside a 75-year-old bomber while it takes to the air, you'll be pleased to hear that you're probably pretty close to the truth. Joe, what was your prevalent impression of the aircraft?
Its sparsity. It was just very utilitarian, not many comforts, and not much excess stuff to get in the way. I think it was designed, you know, for that purpose. But yeah, it was pretty much what I expected as far as it being utilitarian and like I said, sparse.
Yeah, I share your assessment. The interior space is very, very Spartan. This thing, you can tell, is a tool that was built to perform a job, and the comfort of the occupants of that airplane was not the job that it was built for. It's loud. Everything shakes and rattles on the inside.
Very little insulation, so it was very cold at high altitudes.
Very cold, not to mention, and there are obvious and large openings in the fuselage on both the side gun positions and the rear wheel well where... Yeah, the air just pours right in, bringing with it frigid temperatures and an amazing amount of noise.
Yes. Although not as bad as maybe a rock concert, but yes, a constant. It's just there all the time.
Yeah, an ever-present din. Although I have to say, as far as noises go, four radial engines like that, they do sound pretty nice.
True.
There are worse ways to go deaf. The other thing I noticed that I didn't... expect initially, but it did not surprise me when we got there, was the smell of it. It smells like, it has a particular smell that it shares with every other old piece of military hardware I've been around, like the Blueback down at OMSI. It's a combination of epoxy paint and fuel and grease and just age. A lot of people being in a confined space for a long time, it just seeps into every surface, and it has a particular aroma to it that I don't think that you would ever mistake for anything else. See, once you get in it, you think, oh, right, that makes sense.
Right, it kind of has that Army Surplus Store scent to it.
The flight quality itself, although the flight was brief...
That was wonderful.
It was absolutely wonderful, and I did get a sense that this was an aircraft that was completely over-engineered. There was everything was manually controlled. There were multiple layers of redundancy. The wings look like you could literally stand 15 elephants on them, and they wouldn't even sag a bit. This is a robust aircraft, and it is just amazing to think the numbers of these things that were produced over such a short period of time, and how they were utilized in such massive numbers in the European and Pacific theaters.
Right, and like you said about the engines, they're built amazingly well, and it's designed so that if they did lose one or two engines, they'd still make it back.
Yeah, it is a truly phenomenal piece of equipment, and I was so happy that we got a chance to... I would have been happy had it not left the ground at all, just to be on the inside and see what it was like, but to actually get an opportunity to take off with some of the veterans aboard to see their reaction and sort of see the scales lifted from their eyes as they were reliving these moments from 7 decades in the past. It was a very, very moving and amazing thing to see.
That was. It was, yeah, it was just history, living history in front of you, and better than any history book or movie. Although, up till now, my only experience with these planes has been in the movies and my impressions and, you know, the old John Wayne movies and such. And a lot of it kind of did live up to what I expected.
Yes.
Because of those movies.
I would say the one thing that they do not accurately portray in the movies is how difficult it is to move around on the interior of the airplane. If you are someone who is built robustly, like me, that plane is large on the outside, it feels small on the inside. And getting fore and aft through the bomb bay, and especially if you were trying to go down to the tail gunner position, it's not going to be possible if you are of a modern size, shall we say.
That's true. And that's one thing. I never saw an actor in those movies bump their head, and I smacked mine pretty good. And I don't think anyone escaped.
Oh.
Even though intense warnings were given, it was unavoidable.
My bald spot is slightly larger than it was before yesterday. Well, Joe, any other thoughts about the experience of flying in the aircraft?
The one thing that really will stay with me is being able to climb into the nose, the bombardier station, where it was basically just a little bench and with all this gear in front of you, but you were just surrounded by glass, and it's the most amazing view I've ever had in an airplane, and I could have flown on that seat all day.
You really did feel like you were just stuck out in space. There was just nothing in front or below you. You were suspended in midair with this enormous power behind you just pushing you forward. Considering in many ways, the technology of that aircraft is kind of this perfect bridge between archaic and very modern, and the sensation of being in it is entirely unlike anything that I think you were likely to find in anything that has been built since the turn of this century, but even since maybe the 50s or 60s.
I agree. I can totally see that.
If you have the opportunity to be around an aircraft like this, to touch it, to look inside it, to climb inside it, and especially if you have an opportunity to fly in it, by all means, don't pass it up, because it is a sensory experience that will really, really stick with you for a long time. To that end, if you're interested in seeing the Modris Maiden for yourself, it'll be parked at Aero Air, that's A-E-R-O Air, at the Hillsboro Airport, 2050 Northeast 25th Avenue in Hillsboro, this weekend, March 4th and 5th. The Liberty Foundation, a nonprofit that operates two B-17s, the Modris Maiden being one, will be offering flights to the public. If you'd like more information about these flights, a schedule of future flights, or a more detailed history of the Modris Maiden, please visit the Liberty Foundation's website at www.libertyfoundation.org. For KBOO News, I'm Brian Pritchett.
And this is Joe Leno.
Wishing you well until next we meet on the air, or maybe in the air.
Remembering Jim, or Battle, is a poem by war veteran John E. Loomis in memory of a close friend who was killed only an arm's length away. A cocoon of terror shrouds him in a capsule of eternity. Darkness and mud and misting rain envelop comrades whom he cannot see. A flare arching in the sky. Still gray shadows lace the barren moor. A burst of gunfire, grenades exploding with a roar. Blood-red tracers overhead, behind him rose a scream. Hell has broken loose. Oh, could it be a dream? Time stands still. The sky is flashing. A cacophony of fears blasting and tearing, a horror much too sere. Then blackness, quiet, a battle done. He lies as if in sleep, oblivion.
Oh. Tune in to KBOO Wednesday, March 8th for International Women's Day.
We'll be celebrating all day long with special programming focusing on feminism, intersectionality, gender illusions,
and women in jazz, reggae, punk, and metal,
and so much more. That's International Women's Day, 24 hours of programming by women-identified folks for you.
Here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Identities and Futures. Women and non-binary folks speak out March 7th at 7:30 p.m. at Holocene in Portland. Identities and Futures is an evening of performances, animation, and DJs, including DJ Kim Fizzy, Lily Croft, Gene Etheridge, Pocha Radicales, and more. Again, that's Identities and Futures, Women and Non-Binary Folks Speak Out, March 7th at 7:30 p.m. at Holocene. 1001 Southeast Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6 p.m. Coming up next, Rose City Native Radio.
You are listening to a digital indigenous radio show. All across Turtle Island, turn up your radios and decolonize. This is Rose City Native